The candidate for Entered Apprentice stands behind the door, waiting to be summoned. He's blindfolded, and there's a noose around his neck with a length of rope trailing behind. His chest is exposed at the left breast, and his left pant leg rolled up. The doorkeeper raps three times and announces that the candidate desires to enter and obtain the privileges of Freemasonry. With that, the candidate is escorted into the lodge by the inner guard. The guard holds the tip of a dagger against the candidate's bare chest and asks if he feels anything. Next, the candidate kneels before the head of the lodge, the worshipful master, and they engage in a ritual question and answer. He's led by the rope, or cable toe, to an altar with a Bible or other holy book. Standing with his heels together to form a square, the candidate now kneels. He places his right hand on the Bible and with his left presses the point of a compass against his chest. He swears to forever conceal and never reveal any of the secret arts, parts, or points of the hidden mysteries of Freemasonry. If he breaks that promise, he binds himself to having my throat cut across, my tongue torn out, my body buried in the sands of the sea at low tide. The assembled brothers rise and give the sign of the Entered Apprentice, right hand held palm down beneath the chin, with the elbow straight out. The master asks the candidate what he seeks. He replies, the light. The master strikes his gavel, and the hood is removed. Now the candidate is shown three sacred objects, the holy book, the square, and the compass. The master reminds him that he faces terrible retribution should he ever betray the organization's secrets. Next comes instruction in the secret hand sign or grip and the secret word, Boaz. The candidate receives his Masonic badge and the symbolic tools, a gavel and a ruler. The candidate leaves to change clothes and returns to receive the final charges. He is instructed that he must understand the importance of God, must be law-abiding, must abstain from political or religious discussion in the lodge, and must obey the master and other officers. He's again warned he must never reveal any secrets of the Brotherhood. Secrecy, if you haven't noticed, is a big deal. The new brother has entered the first grade of Freemasonry. Above it are two more, fellow craft and master mason. Each has its ritual oath of secrecy and prescribed horrible punishments. In regular or blue lodge masonry, that's all there is to it. But let's take a closer look at the Brotherhood. Arguably the most successful secret society in history. We'll examine how it grew into a worldwide presence and how Freemasonry inspired and influenced many other societies. Many Freemasons object to their order being called a secret society. After all, they don't hide their existence. They openly advertise, as evident from the signs outside almost every American town. Instead, Masons prefer to be called a society with secrets. But our definition of secret societies, selective recruitment, promise of special knowledge or status, and oaths of loyalty and secrecy, fits Freemasonry perfectly. Remember, it's what goes on inside the organization that's secret. The initiation's repeated demands of secrecy make that abundantly clear, and that raises the question of how I, a non-Mason, obtained those details. Very simple. I just looked. They've long been accessible to anybody who bothered. The illusion of secrecy is more important than the reality. It's a common enough phenomenon that Freemasonry even has a name for nosy outsiders, Cowans. Cowan once met a man who practiced the trade without proper accreditation, but it came to signify someone who sought to learn the secrets of Freemasonry without being admitted to the fraternity. You might have gone through the initiation described or one similar. There are many variations. That's because there's never been just one Freemasonry. No one owns the rights to the name. There are many variations, and they don't play by the same rules. Most Masonic lodges don't admit women, but some do. The usual age for admission is 21, but it can be 25 or 18. Here's another example. American Masonic lodges are mostly split between two grand lodges or jurisdictions, the Ancient Free and Accepted Masons, AF and AM, and the Free and Accepted Masons, F and AM. One controls the grand lodges in 24 states, the latter in 25 states. There are two exceptions. South Carolina, which is under its own Ancient Free Masons, AFM, and the District of Columbia, which has the Free and Accepted Masons, FAAM. They mutually recognize each other as regular, but differ in details. Yet all trace their origin to the Grand Lodge of England. So how do you get four jurisdictions out of one Grand Lodge? Hang on, we'll come back to that. But you can see why I call Freemasonry a house of many rooms. Another important point is that the origins of Freemasonry are lost in time. That gives free rein to speculation. While a lodge may consider itself regular and another irregular, that's just a matter of opinion. Ask the average Mason what the lodge is about, and the common answer will be fellowship. Formally, Freemasonry is a system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. Consider again the initiation I described a few moments ago. The candidate entered the lodge through the western door and proceeded towards the worshipful master at the eastern end. That represents the Masonic myth that wisdom, the light, comes from the east, and those in search of it symbolically travel from west to east. The candidate was blindfolded to symbolize his ignorance before the light was received. His breast was exposed to prove he wasn't a woman. His left pant leg was rolled up as evidence that he was able-bodied. Of course, a single exposed limb proves little. It's the symbolism that counts. Similarly, the gavel, square, and apron the new Mason receives are based on actual stonemason gear. But none of them will be used to do real work. With rare exception, no one in the lodge is actually a Mason. They're all just pretending to be. Why? Then there are those terms free and accepted. Free originally meant a man who wasn't a slave or a bondservant, and so who was able to travel from one place to another. Later, it acquired the additional meaning of someone unencumbered by any obligations that might conflict with Masonic ones. An operative Mason is someone who actually knows and works in the trade, a real Mason. Accepted, also called speculative Masons, are men admitted to lodges without any intention of actually laying bricks or stones. They're symbolic Masons. The widely accepted belief is that for some inexplicable reason, stonemason guilds began accepting non-working members. Over time, the accepted brethren, mostly wealthy aristocrats or tradesmen, became dominant, and the real Masons dropped out. The problem with this scenario is that no one can really say how, when, or why it happened. Why would rich guys want to pretend to be common workmen? And why would guilds admit a bunch of dilettantes? Freemasonry also has been called a course of moral instruction aimed at building character and making better men out of good men, i.e., a course in self-improvement. This sounds similar to the late 18th century Bavarian Illuminati's objective to make men free and happy by making them good. It's even reminiscent of the mystical notion that man is God in the making. According to the American esoteric scholar and 33rd degree Mason, Manly P. Hall, Freemasonry is a fraternity within a fraternity, an outer organization concealing an inner brotherhood of the elect. That certainly sounds a little Illuminati-ish. Hall adds that the visible society is a splendid camaraderie of free and accepted men, enjoined to devote themselves to ethical, educational, fraternal, patriotic, and humanitarian concerns. The invisible society is a secret and most august fraternity whose members are dedicated to the service of a mysterious Arcanum Arcanorum, the secret of secrets. Was that the same secret of secrets that alchemists sought? Yet another Masonic scholar, the 19th century American Albert Pike, pronounced Masonry a search for the light that led back to the occult mysteries of the ancient Jewish tradition of Kabbalah. In turn, the Kabbalah connected Freemasonry to Hermeticism, alchemy, and the anti-papal thinkers of the Middle Ages. Did he include among those anti-papal thinkers the notorious Knights Templar and the heretical Cathars? Pike argued that all divine intelligences, gods, angels, and the like, were divided into two principles of good and evil, light and darkness. To Pike, Freemasonry was the successor or revival of the ancient mystery cults. But he viewed regular Blue Lodge Freemasonry as merely the entrance to the temple. Pike's esoteric ideas weren't intended for ordinary Masons. Most brethren are probably unaware of them. Indeed, nothing in his book, Morals and Dogma, was sacramental or obligatory. It was merely Pike's learned opinion. Still, as commander of the Supreme Council of the Masonic Scottish Rite, Pike wasn't without influence. The mention of the Scottish Rite raises the sticky matter of Masonic higher degrees. No Mason is required to go any further than Freemasonry's three craft or blue degrees: Entered Apprentice, Fellow Craft, and Master. Higher degrees are bestowed by so-called rites. They're mostly regarded as purely honorary or ornamental. If you imagine the craft degrees as Cub Scout, Boy Scout, and Eagle Scout, then the higher degrees are like merit badges an Eagle Scout earns to distinguish himself. Other terms for the rites and their higher degrees are speculative or esoteric masonry. This is where the mystical and occult doctrines Pike mentions really come into play. Over time, there have been about 20 Masonic rites. The best known are the Scottish Rite and the York Rite. Others include the Egyptian rites of Memphis and Mizraim. There are or were French, Mexican, and Swedenborgian rites. Among the things they have in common is that they're open only to master, that is, third-degree Masons. But the rites aren't under any authority or any grand lodge. Thus, the higher rites can pretty much do and believe whatever they want. The number of additional degrees offered by the rites varies widely. The Scottish Rite, for example, goes up to 33 degrees. Oddly, the Scottish Rite has no documentable link to Scotland. Its origins actually trace back to France. It also had close, if hard to pin down, connections to the so-called Rite of Strict Observance, and from that to the Rosicrucians. The York Rite is really a combination of three separate Masonic bodies: Royal Archmasonry, Cryptic Masons, and the Commandery of the Knights Templar. The Memphis and Mizraim Rite outdid all others by awarding a whopping 99 degrees. These included intriguing names such as Knight of the Rose Cross, Knight Hermetic Philosopher, Patriarch of Isis, and Pontiff of the Mystic City. The question, of course, is, was this mumbo-jumbo taken seriously, or was it just for show? The answer, certainly, is that it all depended on the initiate. The history of modern Freemasonry begins in 1717 in London. It started with the creation of the Grand Lodge of England. This grew out of four existing lodges and steadily expanded in England and abroad. By 1800, more than 300 affiliated lodges existed in England alone. Separate Grand Lodges appeared in Ireland and Scotland. A franchise was born. But in the 1730s, the Grand Lodge was hit with schism. A dispute broke out between factions dubbed the Ancients and the Moderns. At issue was the importance of rituals and associated mystical traditions. The Moderns, influenced by the rationalism of the Enlightenment, wanted to chuck ritualism. The ancient purists were determined to preserve it. The underlying question was whether Freemasonry was to be a social, i.e. political and philosophical order, or a mystical religious one. The same schism hit American colonial lodges. That explains their division into free and accepted, i.e. modern, and ancient free and accepted, or ancient camps. The ancient and modern rift finally healed in 1813. The moderns yielded on the rituals, and the ancients became more tolerant of politics. Even earlier, in 1799, they were forced to work together to avoid being banned under the British Parliament's new Unlawful Societies Act. Fearing that secret societies were being used to spread French revolutionary ideas and shelter spies, the British government proposed to quash all societies requiring a secret oath. Groups like the pro-revolutionary London Corresponding Society and the United Irishmen were banned. But the Freemasons received an exemption so long as they maintained records of their members. That says a lot about the prestige and influence they'd attained, though it isn't surprising considering that members of the royal family were initiates. Indeed, Freemasonry had become the secret society of choice for the aristocracy and rising middle class. The cost of lodge membership, including the elaborate regalia, kept out the riffraff. If Freemasonry went public in 1717, it certainly didn't start then. Speculative Freemasonry had been slowly evolving for at least 300 years. The 18th century Grand Lodges grew out of older ones, supposedly meeting from time immemorial. For instance, in Scotland, there was the kill-winning Mother Lodge. It claimed to have been around since the 12th century. In York, the independent Grand Lodge of All England traced its origins to 926 and a legendary convention of stonemasons summoned by Anglo-Saxon King Athelstan. The 18th century lodges based their rituals and rules on a collection of documents called the Old Charges, most of which dated to the 15th century. The oldest, the so-called Regius or Halliwell manuscript, may go back to 1390. It mentions the Athelstan legend, but also invokes the Greco-Egyptian mathematician Euclid, who lived around 300 BC. Euclid, the story goes, counterfeited geometry and thereby invented Freemasonry. Of course, how or why Euclid did that, or what counterfeit geometry was, is left a mystery. One of the earliest known Masonic documents is the Cook Manuscript from 1450. It also mentions Euclid, but brings in King Solomon and pushes things all the way back to Adam. The Dowland Manuscript from the mid-1500s elaborates the connection to Solomon's Temple and its legendary master mason, Hiram Abiff. Abiff's death at the hands of three unworthy apprentices became a centerpiece in Masonic mythology. Clearly, no one had any real idea when and how Freemasonry began. The blank canvas made it possible to paint in almost anything. So why not the Knights Templars of the Crusades era? While a Freemason-Templar connection became widely accepted, there's no documentation to back it up. The possible exception is the 15th century Kirkwall scroll from Scotland. It's an illustrated tapestry in which some claim to see Templar and Gnostic symbols. Well, maybe. Or maybe it's a later forgery. But lack of evidence didn't stop American Masons. In 1919, they named their youth auxiliary the De Molays in honor of Jacques de Molay, the last Templar Grand Master, who was burned at the stake in 1314. The historian John Robinson argues for a genuine link between Templars and Freemasons in his 1989 book, Born in Blood. Robinson focuses on the 1381 Peasants' Revolt in England. Robinson believes a shadowy great society behind the revolt was a conspiracy hatched by clandestine Templars aimed at revenge against church and crown. Robinson's evidence is intriguing, but ultimately thin. he does raise some interesting points. For instance, while we picture medieval mason guilds as a kind of trade union, they were really no such thing. Really, they were employer associations run by master masons who treated their lesser brethren as common laborers and indentured servants. Thus, Robinson speculates the Crypto Templars didn't take over genuine guilds, but formed their own pseudo-Masonic guilds as a cover. That, he argues, explains their obsession with secrecy, something not typical among ordinary Masons. Interestingly, the Knights Templar had their own internal sect of Brother Masons, i.e., an internal Masonic guild. Since most of the Templar organizations survived the suppression unscathed, presumably the Brother Masons did as well. There are other examples of political conspiracy disguised as labor association. One is the revolutionary Carbonari, or charcoal burners, of early 19th century Italy and France. There were charcoal burner brotherhoods, but the Carbonari, many of them Freemasons, co-opted the name and terminology as a cover for their revolutionary conspiracies. Among other things, it gave you a plausible reason to be meeting in the woods at night. Still, the Freemason-Templar connection remains mostly conjecture. British Freemasonry would go on to become the secret society of the establishment. In England, 300 lodges grew to 1,000 by the 1860s, 2,000 by the 1880s, and 3,000 by the start of the 20th century. Hundreds more sprouted throughout the empire. The poet laureate of British imperialism, Rudyard Kipling, a Mason, popularized the Brotherhood in his writing. Look at his The Man Who Would Be King. Yet the estimated 250,000 British Freemasons in 1900 were a small fraction of a population of almost 40 million and downright insignificant in a larger imperial population of 400 million. Of course, membership was heavily concentrated at the upper end of society, men who already enjoyed some wealth and power. For some, however, Freemasonry wasn't exclusive or serious enough. One such man was arch-imperialist Cecil Rhodes, the guiding hand behind the creation of British South Africa, the De Beers Diamond Cartel, and the Boer War. Rhodes joined a Masonic lodge in the 1870s because, he said, he saw the wealth and power they possess and the influence they hold. But Rhodes became disillusioned with what he referred to as the lodge's most ridiculous and absurd rites, and thought the order was without an object and without an end. Rhodes' grand idea was to bring the whole uncivilized world under British rule, recover the United States, and make the Anglo-Saxon race one empire. So, along with plotting the British conquest of South Africa's gold and diamonds, Rhodes formed his own secret organization, dubbed the Society of the Elect. Into it, he selectively recruited statesmen, financiers, and industrialists. Part of his scheme, not incidentally, was the Rhodes Scholarship, designed to turn worthy Americans into right-thinking Englishmen. Freemasonry gave Rhodes his starting point, model, and inspiration. Yet while Kipling and Rhodes epitomized Masonic loyalty to the British Empire, not all British Freemasons were so inclined. Remember, that house of many rooms. The Grand Lodge of England was always picky about who and what it regarded as legitimate. Masonic bodies like the Scottish Rite were branded irregular or clandestine. Irregular Freemasonry tended to attract dissidents, both moral and political. There's no finer example than the occultist Aleister Crowley, who was once branded the wickedest man in the world. The Grand Lodge denied any association with Crowley, even that he was a Freemason at all. But Crowley boasted a bevy of Masonic degrees from French, Mexican, and other lodges. The esoteric organizations Crowley was associated with, like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and the Ordo Templi Orientis, or OTO, all had Masonic roots. The OTO, for instance, was initially envisioned as a Masonic academy that would unify Masonic rites with mystical orders to create a unified occult Freemasonry. Another clandestine branch was co-masonry. It initiated men and women alike. The practice originally started in some 18th century French lodges. It resurfaced in 1893 with the founding of the Parisian lodge Le Droit Humain, or Human Right. Co-masonry was later hijacked by English occultists connected to the mystical Theosophical Society. Theosophy sought to combine Western and Eastern mysticism into a universal occult doctrine. It would inspire much of what we now call the New Age movement. Along with a thirst for spiritual enlightenment, some theosophists nurtured political ambitions. One of these was the English woman Annie Besant, who was largely responsible for turning co-masonry into an appendage of theosophy. Besant's politics were definitely radical. She was a socialist, a militant proponent of Indian nationalism, and later flirted with communism. Her Freemasonry definitely wasn't the same as Rudyard Kipling's. While politics was officially forbidden within the lodge, it was practically impossible to keep out. Masonic lodges, remember, were selective. A single dissenting vote could blackball a candidate. The frequent result was a lodge full of men sharing more or less common views, and all sworn to secrecy. Connections formed inside the lodge could take on a different dimension outside of it. Simply put, Masonic lodges were like petri dishes for political conspiracy. This was most obvious in French Freemasonry and the continental lodges it spawned and influenced. Interestingly, even French Freemasonry was of English origin. The first lodges were set up by British merchants in Dunkirk in 1721. In 1733, a Grand Loge de France was formed. It, too, was mostly English-speaking, and an extension of the London Grand Lodge. 40 years later, however, the French Masons formed a new Grand Lodge, the Grand Orient de France. It was strongly influenced by the radical ideas of the Enlightenment. While English Freemasonry became the mainstay of the social order, the Grand Orient became an incubator of revolutionary sentiments. It passed this radical flavor on to lodges in Italy, Germany, Turkey, and Russia. It's no coincidence that the motto of the Grand Orient, liberty, equality, and fraternity, became one of the mottos of the French Revolution. Nowhere was this radical streak stronger than in the Parisian Nine Sisters Lodge, formed in 1776, the same year as the Bavarian Illuminati and the beginning of the American Revolution. American revolutionary Benjamin Franklin was an initiate of the Nine Sisters. So too was his friend and anti-religious French philosopher, Voltaire, and many other men destined to play a part in France's coming upheaval. Fears that Freemasonry nurtured and encouraged dangerous ideas, while exaggerated, weren't baseless. And no one looked on the Freemasons with greater displeasure than the papacy. In 1738, Pope Clement XII issued the first edict against Freemasonry. He said that it had caused the greatest suspicion in the mind of the faithful, and that all prudent and upright men had judged them depraved and perverted. He condemned and prohibited Freemasonry now and forever. As Clement saw it, the Freemasons' obsession with secrecy condemned them. For if they were not doing evil, he reasoned, they would not have so great a hatred of the light. The Catholic Church also figured in an anti-Masonic brouhaha that infected France in the 1890s. This was the so-called Taxil hoax. A journalist, ex-Freemason, and sometimes pornographer named Joseph Jogan Paget decided to exploit public anxiety over Freemasonry and Satanism by combining the two. Writing under the names Leo Taxil and Dr. Bataille, he churned out sensational books such as The Mysteries of Freemasonry and The Devil in the 19th Century. His potboiler story was that Freemasonry was run by a satanic cult, the Palladians, based in, who'd have guessed it, Charleston, South Carolina, And the head devil worshiper was no less than American Freemason Albert Pike. Jogan Paget even conjured a Masonic high priestess, Diana Vaughn, who spun lurid tales of black masses and child sacrifice. For good measure, she was supposed to be the descendant of the 17th century British alchemist and Rosicrucian, Thomas Vaughan. In 1897, Jogan Paget further shocked everyone, especially the Vatican, when he revealed that the whole thing was a hoax and Diana Vaughan a figment of his imagination. Nevertheless, that didn't and hasn't stopped some from insisting the story was true. The most important thing to take away is that Freemasonry isn't one thing, but many, and it always has been. What was true in your granddad's lodge isn't necessarily true for others. Much of this vagueness and variety stems from the fact that Freemasons' origins are lost in time. So what wasn't known was invented. As ever, people see what they want to see and believe what they want to believe.